Hey everybody, I'm Phil, and welcome back to another It's Del Toro Time Twitter-sode. The Twitter-sodes are special short episodes where I cover a movie that Guillermo del Toro recommended on Twitter, but for whatever reason didn't make the main Ecstasy of Influence list. And this time, we are covering Mrs. Miniver from 1942, directed by William Wyler. William Wyler is known for directing The Best Years of Our Lives, but Mrs. Miniver was his first, like, mainstream dip into wartime. Well, I've come across a number of essays on Mrs. Miniver that use the hilarious phrase borderline propaganda to describe the movie. And I find that hilarious because Mrs. Miniver is not borderline propaganda. Mrs. Miniver is explicitly propaganda. It is a term used by the film's production team, by the film's writers, by the film's director, by the cast. Mrs. Miniver was commissioned and produced and released with the intention of it being wartime propaganda. That we should not mince words about that. It's a propaganda film. It is a beautifully made propaganda film. It is a wonderfully written propaganda film and a wonderfully acted propaganda film. But it exists almost solely to gin up American support for participation in World War II. Now, the time the movie was created and released is an unusual. Looking back, it's kind of weird. It fits into a lot of weird slots. This is an American film made with an American and British cast that's set in England during the war. During the war. Like, it's about the way the war affected the English countryside and how it turned people from just sort of disconnected upper middle class people into participants in this war, into victims of the war, into just unwitting conspirators in the campaign to win the war. And it was made and released while they were going through all of this. The tragedies and the terror of war wasn't just fresh on their minds, it was in front of their faces. So we have an American production with a British director directing Britons and Americans in a movie set in England during the war, in which the movie is set during that war. It's very immediate. It's very important. And President Roosevelt himself had this movie rushed to release upon its completion. It was believed to be so important because, you see, at the time, American support for World War II in general, like the notion that we would jump in and fight in this war, the support for that was fairly low in the popular consensus. There was a lot of belief that it was just something that we shouldn't be involved in. We had our own financial troubles at the time. War is expensive, and it wasn't really our problem. That was something going on over in Europe, and it wasn't going to touch us. Add to that the fact that Hollywood had a lot at stake in there not being a huge war at the time, because if there's a war in Europe, we can't distribute films over there very easily. And if our allies get all mixed up and start getting bombed and attacked, it's really hard to sell your films over there. So as horrible as that sounds, Hollywood kind of had an interest for a while in not getting involved in the war. But William Wyler himself had a vested interest in producing movies to help out the war effort, because he was from Europe and he had a lot of sympathy for what was going on over there. He was strongly the anti-fascist. He was very pro-ally, and he made documentary films. He risked his life to make documentary films about the war. He was a very active participant in the war effort, and Mrs. Miniver kind of stands as his first, like, really just planting his flag in what he's going to do. And it helps that it's also a very well-made film. Mrs. Miniver is based on a book that is a compilation of columns about a character named Mrs. Miniver. The author was Jan Struther, and she would write these just fictionalized pieces in order to sort of illustrate what life in England was like. I mean, I hesitate to use that she was the Dave Barry of her day, but she wasn't the Dave Barry of her day. That's a terrible thing to say. I mean, I like Dave Barry. Don't get me wrong. I really like Dave Barry. But this is nothing at all like Dave Barry. But they were just sort of like the foibles of everyday life. That was kind of the point of the Mrs. Miniver character. Just to sort of reflect on what it was like. But then as World War II crept up, the column started getting a little more serious, because all of a sudden this was something that we couldn't ignore, and it had to be reflected in the everyday lives of the participants. And so the book was published, and the movie is based more or less on it. But the film, of course, added a lot of drama, a lot of plot that's not in the book, and created its own story for its own purposes. So Greer Garson, a wonderful actress, ended up getting cast as Mrs. Miniver. Her husband was played by Walter Pidgeon, who was already an established name. And show favorite, Teresa Wright from Shadow of a Doubt is back. I already love Teresa Wright. I loved her in Shadow of a Doubt. She's back in Mrs. Miniver as the love interest of the son, played by Reginald Owen. So we have this very strong cast to sort of portray this upper middle class family. And what the movie is about, basically, is this family in England who live an upper middle class life and don't really have much to worry about except how much to spend on a new car, how much to spend on a new hat. Their son coming back from college with crazy new ideas about the class system in England and how it needs to be abolished. And in the background, for the first, like, I'd say 30 minutes of the film, we get a few whisperings of war. We know that the war is, you know, going on, but it's nothing that anyone in England has to worry about. And then at about the 30-minute point, England officially goes to war. The son enlists. The father has to start participating in the security detail, like the night watch, because they are right on the edge. Like the German bombings are getting closer and closer. The son becomes a flyboy. He's taking off from the airfield every night to go fight the Germans, to go protect the shores. And you hear the bombs in the background. The Minivers get a bomb shelter that they start having to spend more and more time in. As the Blitz starts occurring, they start having to do blackouts. And you watch this movie, you watch these characters slowly get used to this new normal. At the same time, you watch the sort of stiff upper lip attitude. You never see them succumb to despair. You never see them treated as anything other than a mild inconvenience, even when stuff starts getting really serious. Now, Teresa Wright shows up early on as Carol Belden. She's the granddaughter of Lady Belden, who is kind of the local dowager. She's sort of sour. She looks down on the lower classes. And Carol and the Miniver's son, Vin, butt heads when they first meet, which means, of course, in the world of romantic comedies, they immediately fall in love. They fall in love. They court. They ultimately get married. What's crazy about this movie is you go through all of this stuff. You're constantly watching Vin grow from a hot-headed youth with a lot of like ideas about, you know, society and social life and where people stand, into a more mature young man. And the movie does this wonderful, you're led to believe the whole time. It's set up in such a way that you know what's coming is you're going to eventually have to deal with the death of Vin, because there's a lot of foreshadowing that the pilots are constantly in danger. There's crashes. You know that Vin is going to be the sacrificial lamb. He is going to be the linchpin on which the drama will turn. We'll get to that. But there's other things that happen in this movie. At one point, a downed pilot shows up in their garden. A German pilot who has been being hunted is a big manhunt out for this German pilot. They know crashed. He takes Mrs. Miniver hostage, holds her at gunpoint. She manages to wait him out until he collapses from fatigue, so she can get the gun away from him. It's an extremely tense sequence. Her husband gets called out to go help at Dunkirk, which is just kind of a thing that happens in the background. Like, you either know what Dunkirk is or you don't. He disappears for a while. That's when the whole, like, her getting held hostage occurs. She tells him about it later on, too, and he's like, I think he just slaps her on the butt for, like, being, like, sassy. Like, that's it. Like, she's like, I was held hostage at gunpoint by a crazed Nazi. And he's all, smack. That'll learn ya. Like, it's a weird moment. I don't know. I guess it's their playfulness, but it kind of stands out. I don't know. They're all under a lot of stress. There's World War II going on. So, you know, there's a marriage. There's multiple scenes in the bomb shelter. There's two adorable little children. Okay, these little kids, Toby and Judy. The kid who plays Toby, Christopher Severn, is amazing. He's almost too cute. He's almost too sweet, but it works. He's a brilliant little actor. You think he's going to be too cloying, but what they do is they present Toby and Judy as these adorable little Muppets, and they warm your heart eventually. They earn your love, and then you get the final bomb shelter scene where the bombs are literally shaking the walls and knocking them out of their beds. And the little kids are legitimately panicking and freaking out and screaming and crying. And it makes that's the moment where the war suddenly becomes extraordinarily real in this movie. There's no pretense anymore. You're not watching a charming family film. You're watching war happen around these people. So all this goes along, and in the end of the film, spoiler alert, just in case you don't want to know, skip ahead a few minutes, but what ends up happening is there's a big celebration going on, which we'll get to, in the town, and afterwards there's another air raid. The Germans are coming. Vin has to be driven back to his base. He's just come home for a visit. Then he has to be driven home. Mrs. Miniver and Carol drive him back to his base. On the way back, though, they get caught because the sun goes down. It's extremely dark. They cannot drive with their headlights on because of, for security reasons, they can't be seen by the Germans. And they get literally caught in the middle of an air battle. There's bombs falling everywhere around them. And they have to ultimately pull over because they can't see and it's not safe to drive. And so they're watching this air battle take place right above them. And they know that Vin is one of the people out fighting in this battle. And then the worst thing happens. A British plane crashes right by the car. And Mrs. Miniver is sure that it's Vin, and there's like a shot of the plane, and you're just like, that's it, like there's Vin, like that's the death of our son, that's the death of the character, here's where it's all gonna come home. She turns to talk to Carol because Carol's being quiet and Carol's acting weird. Mrs. Miniver looks up, and in one of the most haunting images I've ever seen in a movie like this, she sees in the roof of the car a series of bullet holes, and you realize that a German plane, or a plane, you're not even sure what plane it was, has flown overhead and strafed their car and just shot Carol almost to death. There's a long, drawn-out death scene. Mrs. Miniver gets her back to the house, and it's incredibly sad. She can't get emergency services because they're all busy helping other people who've been killed by the bombing raid. And Carol dies in Mrs. Miniver's arms, and the very last scene takes place in the bombed out church in town. And it's a very strange scene because you expect it. The question gets asked by the minister. Why does bad things happen? Why are bad things happening to people in this war? And he points out that a little boy, one of the choir boys, was killed in the raid that night. An old man who we'll get to was killed in the raid, and Carol was killed in the raid. Carol's not even like singled out, though. It's like she's just one of the people we've lost in the last couple of days. And he says, why do we have to lose these people? You would expect him to be like we don't. War is terrible, and these are the innocent victims of war. They didn't ask for this. They didn't bring it on. It's unfair that they were sacrificed for something they had no part in. He doesn't say that, though. Remember, this is a propaganda film. And it is explicitly propagandistic. And he says, I'm just going to quote this. He says, why should they be sacrificed? He says, because this is not only a war of soldiers in uniform, it is a war of the people, of all the people. And it must be fought not only on the battlefield, but in the cities and in the villages, in the factories and on the farms, in the home and in the heart of every man, woman, and child who loves freedom. Well, we've buried our dead, but we shall not forget them. Instead, they will inspire us with an unbreakable determination to free ourselves and those who come after us from the tyranny and terror that threaten to strike us down. This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us, and may God defend the right. And it's so jarring because you don't expect the minister to say, like, why'd they die? Because they're just as much a warrior as the rest of them. You don't expect them to be like, well, because they're fighters in this war. Even the children. If you die, well, you're a soldier too. We're all soldiers now, everyone. I'm not used to that. It's not a typical thing. Like in modern war films, the soldiers are the soldiers, the victims are the victims. And this is a movie that basically says, we don't have time for that. Yep, it's really sad that a main character died. Get your gun, Johnny, and go fight the Nazis, okay? Because that's what we need to worry about at this moment. The movie came out because American sympathy for England was at an all-time low, not just because we didn't want to get involved in the war, but because American attitudes toward the British were that they were old-fashioned and foppish and aristocratic, that they were mired in this ancient system of social class, and they worshipped a queen or a king, and we didn't get that. They had a royal family. Like, it was all weird. They were very foreign to Americans. They were, even in movies, like the British were very othered the way they were portrayed. Even though Hollywood had a lot of British filmmakers, a lot of famous British actors that we all loved, there was still this idea that they weren't like us. They weren't Americans. And you know what? Maybe if they get taken over by another country, so be it. Like, there was just wasn't a lot of sympathy there. And so when Mrs. Miniver was adapted, the first thing they did was they made her family less rich. She's pretty rich in the movie. They made her family less rich than in the book. And they slowly started adding stuff to make the characters more American in their attitudes. There's a lot of talk about breaking down the barriers of the social classes. It's done a little ironically. Like, Vin is like, you gotta, you know, the upper class and middle class, that shouldn't be a thing. Like, upper class, like, there shouldn't be any class distinctions. And then he like yells at the maid because, you know, he's still a kid, basically. But that was done. That was added so that the American audience would be like, yeah, the British are okay. Now, while the movie was in pre-production, we weren't involved in the war. We hadn't gone full hog into the war. But then Pearl Harbor happened, and then things just started ticking right along. Rewrites were going just left and right. The closer we got to the war, the more and more extreme it became. The example they always give is the scene where Mrs. Miniver is taken hostage by the Nazi. Originally, he was just a sort of like tired soldier who she brought into the house. And the more they rewrote it, the more evil he became, until William Wyler said, like, you know, it started out with her finding a German soldier, and it ended, the final draft was finally her fighting a Nazi. Like, he went from being a soldier to a Nazi at the end, like spewing rhetoric and like insulting the Allies, and just, nope, this is the bad, like, this isn't Summer of My German Soldier, okay? This is a Nazi who's holding you hostage. Like, that was a very intense scene. And the final monologue by the minister, the one that I quoted from, it's twice that long, by the way. It's a long monologue. The final piece by the minister was actually reprinted in multiple languages and distributed around the world. Like, that's what sold it. That's what made Roosevelt stand up and go, okay, this is the movie. This is the movie that's going to carry us into the war. And it did. It totally worked. I think Hermann Goering mentioned Mrs. Miniver as like, this is the worst thing that's happened to the Nazis. Like, this is the piece of propaganda that was produced that really affected the war, that like changed, that turned the tide. Like, you can overstate it, but pop culture has a lot of influence in people's attitudes. I don't know if you've noticed. So I mentioned earlier that there is an old man who died. James Ballard was the character's name. And he was played by Henry Travers, who you might recognize as Clarence the Angel from It's a Wonderful Life. And his part in the movie is that he plays a station master, I think. And yes, and he sees Mrs. Miniver every day, and she's always very kind to him. He's a hobbyist, a flower grower, and he grows a new kind of rose that he names the Mrs. Miniver after her. And he's going to enter it in the flower competition. And it's considered kind of bad form for him to do that because he's lower class. And the flower competition is Lady Belden's flower competition. And she's the grand dame, and she always wins the flower competition. She always has the winning rose. At this point, it's just tradition. She always wins it. Even though it's kind of her thing, she's the winner. And he's like, no, I think I have a right to enter my rose. And so there's this subplot going on. Will the Mrs. Miniver rose even be entered? Will he actually do it? And does it even stand a chance of winning? And before the final scenes, you finally get the rose competition. And Lady Belden is, of course, not only the winner, but she's the person who makes the winner announcement. And so she's there to announce herself the winner again. And at the last minute, she crumples up the paper and declares Mr. Ballard the winner, because she realizes that the Mrs. Miniver rose is more beautiful than her rose. And she humbles herself for the first time. And Lady Belden is one of the characters who has one of the best arcs in this movie, because she's presented as the bad guy. Not really the antagonist, but she's the best. You know she's going to get shown hers by the end, is how she's set up. And instead, she grows to be a lovely character in this movie. She overcomes a lot of her snobbishness. And you realize that her pride and her snobbery isn't just because she feels she's better than other people. It's very much held in a lifetime of pain and loss. And that's an incredible character to play. This whole movie is filled with incredible characters, from the maid and her boyfriend. They have a little story that goes on. He goes off to war, and because he's a lower class person, he doesn't get the options that Vin gets when he rushes into war. Vin gets basically his pick of what he gets to do in battle, and the lower classes don't get that. They kind of just become cannon fodder. And there's a lot of little moments like this throughout the film. And I don't want to sell it as just a sad war film. Mrs. Miniver is, in a lot of ways, it's delightful and very funny. And the characters are very real, and it's very well written. It's just a solid flick. And of course, it was a solid flick. It won Best Picture. It won Best Director. It won Best Actress for Greer Garson. And it won Best Supporting Actress for Teresa Wright. But Walter Pidgeon may have been nominated for Best Actor, I believe. It was a hailed film. It was heralded. People loved Mrs. Miniver. Still do. William Wyler, of course, went on to win more Academy Awards for Best Director. I think he won 3. He's the most nominated director of all time. 12 nominations. 3 wins, 12 nominations. And there's a weird, world record. He has the world record. He has the record for the most Best Picture wins that he directed. Like, not the most director wins, but the most films a single director directed won Best Picture. 3 of his movies won Best Picture, and I guess that's a record, which I seems small to me. Like, I would think that there's directors out there who've had more of their films win Best Picture, but I guess not. 3 is it. As of 2018, 3 is still it. Yeah, so it was an instant classic, an instant hit. And I find it a shame that today it's held up against The Best Years of Our Lives, which was William Wyler's sort of huge war movie that people really celebrate and really really talk about. I feel it's a shame that people are always like, well, Mrs. Miniver, you always have to compare it to Best Years of Our Lives, which is the better war movie. And I'm like, it's really kind of neither here nor there, because Best Years of Our Lives is a post-war movie and Mrs. Miniver is a mid-war movie. I think the only thing it suffers from is the fact that it is propagandistic. It is serving a purpose, and at times it shows its hand a little too much for my comfort. I like my propaganda to be a little more subtle, but bearing in mind that it was a movie of its era serving a specific point to that day, like not even to that year, but to that moment, it does a great job. There was a sequel to it called The Miniver Story in 1950, years later, where Greer Garson and Walter Pidgeon played Mr. and Mrs. Miniver once again. Their son Vin was not in the movie, probably because the actor who played him, Richard Nye, went on to marry Greer Garson after Mrs. Miniver. There was a 12-year difference in their ages, and it didn't last long. Apparently, it was a terrible marriage. It lasted like a year and a half. They got divorced. He eventually quit acting and got a job as like an investment counselor, something like that. He went off, did other stuff. But he was married to Greer Garson. It was very strange. They played. If you watch the movie knowing that, you're like, oh, it's a little, I guess, tension between mother and son. I don't know. It's very strange. The Miniver Story, not as well received, but considered by some people to be a decent film, I guess. Sad, from what I understand. There was also a made-for-TV movie of Mrs. Miniver with Maureen O'Hara. I don't know. Haven't seen it. Mrs. Miniver is available on DVD and Blu-ray. It's a beautiful film. It looks great. There's not much else to say about it. The version I got didn't have a lot of extra features or anything, but the Blu-ray looks great. It's crisp, it's clean, it's got, the sound is fine. For its time, it's okay. Not a whole lot of special features, but if you're looking for a good movie to pick up, I'd pick up Mrs. Miniver. It's worth a look. I would say the only thing that threw me off from ever watching it in the past was the title. I was like, who's Mrs. Miniver? It's over 2 hours long, too. It's 133 minutes. This is a 2 hour and 15 minute long film. I was fine with that. Some people complain about the length. They say it drags kind of in the second half kind of drags a while. I think it takes its time setting everything up. So, set aside an evening. Watch Mrs. Miniver. Highly recommended. Guillermo del Toro, in his tweet about it, April 2016, said, Mrs. Miniver by William Wyler. Wyler was precise and emotional. This is a film in which he displays both. Beautiful heartbreak. And I totally agree with Del Toro's assessment. It's a well-crafted film. The camera does amazing things. The cinematography is gorgeous. The characters are well-framed. Everybody gets a moment. Everybody gets their close-up. Not a single character is wasted. As a director, he really outdid himself just getting performances out of these people. You really believe in the family relationship. And you really believe in the impact that war has on these characters. My only confusion comes from the fact, not really confusion, but I know that Del Toro, his history with war films is always that the innocent in war are victims. They are unwilling participants in war, specifically the children. And this movie, Mrs. Miniver, takes such a hard stance that, nope, it's your war. Doesn't matter if you're a kid, you're part of this. If there's war, you're a fighter. And I disagree, and I think Del Toro disagrees with that. So, but I understand where he's coming from. It's still a very human story. It's still very much about how war affects everybody. And that's so much a part of what Del Toro does. Plus, like he says, it's precise. This is a movie made by artists and people at the height of their ability to craft a motion picture. And that's one, people think Del Toro is all about horror and monsters, and that's true. There's a lot of that in his movies, but never forget that his movies are about the precision of filmmaking, about not wasting a shot, not wasting a moment, making sure that everything on screen moves that story forward and contributes to the overarching theme of what you are going for. And if Mrs. Miniver does that, it does it in abundance. It says, okay, we're making a propaganda film about how the war negatively is impacting the British. Let's do it. We're going to show you the most wonderful British family you've ever met. We're going to make them warm and human, and then we're going to destroy their hearts with war. And that is what Mrs. Miniver does. So that is Mrs. Miniver. Buy it on Blu-ray. Buy it on DVD. It's out there. Pick up a copy. Check it out. 1942. You will not be disappointed. The next Twitter-sode, by the way, is going to be the best years of our lives. The next is going to be William Wyler. In case you're wondering, there was this movie comes between Sullivan's Travels on our little list and Shadow of a Doubt. So this is before our Teresa Wright movie, Shadow of a Doubt, and after Sullivan's Travels. So then our main body of episodes, we have Shadow of a Doubt, Beauty and the Beast, and now I'm hitting Best Years of Our Lives. So stay tuned for that one. You're going to be hearing a few more Twitter-sodes than usual because Ollie has started school. So Ecstasy of Influence and Guillermo del Toro movies might take a short back seat, but rather than just canceling the show altogether for a month, I'm just going to be putting out some Twitter-sodes. I'm going to be watching some movies. I do love the movies. So bear with me, and we'll get back to our main line of films once classes settle down and ACTs are taken and college applications are sent out. I'm a father, and this is scaring the heck out of me. So please bear with. Thank you all for listening. Like us on Facebook. You can go to Twitter. We are at Del Toro Time on Twitter. So go follow us on there and let us know what you think. Review us on iTunes. I would love to know what people think about It's Del Toro Time. Anything else you'd like to hear from us, just let us know. And I will see everyone. I won't see you at all. I will talk at you, though, next time when it's Del Toro Time.